On this sixth day of July 2011 in San Diego, we are reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 11, General History, Chapter 22, The Elements of Material Creation, text number 7. Paraspara anupraveshat tatvanam purusha rishabha parva aparya prasankyanam yatha vaktuhu vivakshitam paraspadanu praveshat padaspadanu praveshat tatvanam purusharshabha parvaparya prasankyanam yata vaktu vivakshitam paraspadanu praveshat tatvanam purusharshabha parvaparya prasankyanam yata vaktu vivakshitam. Translation: O best among men, because subtle and gross elements mutually enter into one another, philosophers may calculate the number of basic material elements in different ways, according to their personal desire. Purport: Material creation takes place as a chain reaction in which subtle elements expand and transform into progressively denser elements. Since a cause is in a sense present within its effect, and the effect is subtly present within the cause, all subtle and gross elements have entered within one another. Thus, one may categorize basic material elements in many different ways, assigning various numbers and names according to one's methodology. Although material philosophers proudly assume their individual theories to be supreme, they are all speculating according to their personal proclivities, as described in this and the following verse. Om jnana tamarandasya jnanandana shalakaya chukshu unmidatam mena tasmai shri gurave namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance. My spiritual master Srila Prabhupada opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisances unto him and all members of Sri Parampara. So this is a fascinating section of this Srimad Bhagavatam in which Krishna is describing in not great detail as you find in other places like Third Canto, but how the material energy manifests and what the relationship is between the different elements that we experience, gross and subtle, and also the Supreme Person, how his glance is what activates it, and without that presence of the Supreme Person or the soul, these elements are just like ingredients sitting on the shelf in the kitchen there. Nothing happens, nothing gets cooked, unless Nityagora is in there, living entity, moving things around. So one of the interesting things here is that the elements enter into each other. Since they proceed from subtle to gross, and we've gone over this many times, and it's quite intuitive that the effect contains the cause within it. You see what I'm saying? That's one of the reasons why we can intuitively understand, why it makes perfect sense, why the Supreme Person, the cause of all causes, is a person. Prabhupada makes this point at the beginning of the Ishopanishad, in the very first purport, that if the Supreme cause of everything, assuming that we're looking for the absolute truth and the absolute truth is the source of everything, then it must have everything that we see in the creation and much more. It can't have anything less. So personality is clearly superior or different from impersonality. So therefore the Supreme must have personality and also impersonal aspect. It can't be that it's just an impersonal. Because personality is all, we're persons. We have form, we have activities, desires, senses, all of these things. So the Supreme must have all of that and more because he's the cause of everything. You see, I gave this example, I think it was Sunday night. how, take this building. There's a series of causes, right? The first being the idea in somebody's mind. I want to build a building to make money, you know, or whatever. Right? So what kind of building? So, all right, let's build a warehouse. Let's build a movie theater. Let's build an apartment building, something. So that idea then manifests as a blueprint and so forth, and you may call in other people to help. And so there's many different causes. But it begins with a subtle idea and proceeds then to something which eventually is this building made of gross elements, isn't it? So, but there's nothing here that wasn't first an idea. Every one of these paintings, every one of these little works of sculpture was first conceived of by somebody and then executed and manifest the way it is, you see? So creation proceeds from subtle to gross, and in one sense, just like you see a painting, those of us who have been experienced with these painters for many years, you can tell the different styles, you know, to some degree. Like I know that painting in the corner there is by Jadarani. She has a little different style. So the personality of the person enters into whatever they create. So in this way, the subtle enters into the gross manifestation, and you can see some of the person in their creation, isn't it? It's like that. Music style. You're hearing a sound, but you're reminded of a certain person. You know, the words, the music, that's, you know, custom made. So one of the things that's interesting here is in our own practical devotion, I always like to bring it back, well, what do we use, how do we use this knowledge to, you know, in our daily life? And that is that the mind is also a material element, a subtle material element, but it's still material. So each of us has a mind, just as we have a hand, we have a mind, obviously. And when we contemplate anything, we contemplate the object of the senses, say, which is natural. The mind is kind of working with the senses. The mind is like the sixth sense. And something pleasant comes in your you know, vision, right? Or something you hear pleasant. So then you, if you become fixed on it, just like Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, dhyayato vishayanpungsa, when your mind becomes fixed on some vishaya, some object of the sense, then the attraction develops. If it's an attractive thing, the attraction develops. Sangha develops, right? So what is that sangha? Well, in one sense, the mind is entering into that thing. And at the same time, the thing is entering into the mind. That we can understand, right? You walk past a billboard and some attractive, you know, member of the opposite sex on there is selling something. Well, the whole idea is that that's going to enter into your mind. You're going to go past the billboard in 5 seconds, but that impression is there. And it awakens a desire. The basic, you know, animal desire is then associated with the product they're trying to sell you. It's very scientific. So that's entered in there. And then the next time you want some, you're trying to buy a car, you haven't long forgot about the billboard in your conscious mind, but it's in there. And you're associated, yeah, I think a Lexus would be good. You remember, yeah, you know, it's associated with something very pleasurable. You see that? So all of these things are entering into the mind, and the mind is also becoming absorbed in them. So now the intelligence is very, very close to the soul. And the intelligence can be trained so that it directs the mind not to become absorbed in things that you know are going to drag you down. You have a goal in mind that's greater than just enjoying the senses, gross or subtle, in this world. And that's what all of this knowledge is meant to do, is to provide you a framework with your intelligence so that you can use what you have, these gross elements in the form of senses, subtle elements in the form of the mind, for your elevation, for the best destination. Because we're all going somewhere. We're all being pushed along by time. You can't stop it. It's that aspect of Krishna. Very powerful. So, but we're not completely slaves of our instincts and our senses in this form, as a human form. We have the ability, we have the good fortune also, now to come in touch with this philosophy by which the intelligence can be strengthened and understood so that we can direct the mind and the senses. Otherwise, we become controlled by the object of the senses, right? What is that? Indianam parabhyebhyak parangmanaha. Manasastu para buddha yobuddhe padatastu sah. That the sense objects, it's in one sense, are superior to the senses when the senses are simply allowed to be controlled by them. It's supposed to be that the soul, you know, in touch with the super soul, purifies the intelligence, right? The intelligence is now in control. Controls the mind controls the senses, and the senses engage in the sense objects, not for sense gratification, but for the purpose of serving Krishna. That's the higher self-control in the lower self. When we forget about the super soul, and the soul is riding along, having given over its power of attorney to the lower self, right? Then we become controlled by the sense objects. Senses are being pulled around. This is what the purveyors of advertising want you to do. They don't want you to use your intelligence. They try to bypass the intelligence, or they fill your intelligence with these ideas of sense gratification, and then they've got you. You know, they're selling something. Like, they don't want you to be satisfied with what you have. That's the last thing they want, right? So, like this, you know, this iPod, which can be used for Christian service, but they purposely hold back features, you know, like they put a camera here. But it's a crappy camera, you know, 1 megapixel or something. So now they'll come out with, you know, version 5, oh, now it's a 4 megapixel picture. And they could have done that, but they wanted to make you dissatisfied so that they've got you, you know, you got to have the iPod. So now, okay, now I'll have, you know, buy something new. This beer, that beer, you know, this car, that car, you know. So this is the sense objects controlling the senses, controlling the mind, controlling intelligence, and you're completely bound up. So the idea is, now, different philosophers look at this world in different ways, and it's perfectly reasonable to analyze it in different ways. But if that's all you do, you know, that's all they're doing, is analyzing this different world, these different elements. This is basically what the scientists are doing, very expertly. You know, they get down into the elements and they find, you know, a combination of elements that'll blow up their enemy. You know, that's the basic animal thing. The greatest, the most energy and the most progress, if you want to call it that, in science is in weaponry. They're doing things we don't even know what they're doing. They have unlimited funds, you know, to pay people, you know, with no morals, to figure out better ways of killing people and controlling people. In my day, when we would go on a demonstration, sometimes you'd face a phalanx of cops, you know. It'd be pretty scary because they'd have these shields, you know, that you couldn't see their faces, and they'd all have billy clubs, you know, and they'd all be like, this, I'm thinking of New York now, you know, something. And they'd be standing there, you know, and at any moment they're going to rush you, you know. Okay, but at least you can run, you know, you can throw a rock. I never did that, by the way. But you have, yeah, there's some. Now, you know, if you try to have a demonstration, they'll pull up a truck, and they have these things, infrared, that, you know, it's actually like microwave ovens. They've got it down, so they can project that at a distance, burn your skin, so it's not fatal or anything, but it hurts a lot. And you go running around screaming away or fall to the ground. Or they have sounds. You know, you'll see these guys, they come, they have all the, you know, they have these big things. Not my little noise cancellers, but the huge things that the guys who with the jackhammers use. And they have this sound truck, you know, this piercing sound that'll just make you crazy and, you know, fall to the ground and disperse. They want you to disperse. That's the main thing. If you disperse, then, you know, you're helpless. So who thought that up? You know, some scientist, some guy, you know, okay, here's $1 million, $100,000. Now, figure out a better way that we can control crowds, you know. So this is the same intelligence, the same mind, being used for the lowest purpose, you know, demonic. This is demonic. So just to analyze this world, there's nothing spiritual about it, you know. Krishna is saying, yeah, the different philosophers, they see it in different ways. It's the same basic earth, water, fire, air, ether. The Greeks knew about it. In the study of the Greeks, they talked about these things. Big deal. Okay, fine. Unless they get to the point of, the, you know, as Bhakti Chu Swami was saying, the 25th element, the 26th element, the soul, the super soul, then it doesn't really help, and it can easily be misused, as the president, the scientists do it. So that's why the Bhagavatam is always bringing us to that point. In this very chapter, it's always titled The Elements of Material Creation, but it doesn't neglect to explain how the glance of the Lord, you know, is what makes everything happen and makes these elements manifest into this material world, which, after all, has a purpose. This is another question. You know, we're talking about philosophers and their, you know, cogitations. That's one of the main things, at least when I was growing up. Young people wanted to ask that. I don't know if it's the same way now. But, you know, why is there anything? What's the purpose of it all? Do I have is there a meaning to life? Or is it just atoms in the void, you know, paraspara, some, you know, as Krishna says in the Gita, demoniac view. Everything is happening by chance. There's no meaning to anything, and there's no morality. You know, that was the main answer. Existentialism, I think, mainly came to that answer. God doesn't make any sense. God is dead. You know, probably saw that in a magazine. He'd like to use that a lot. God is dead. Well, it means that these people who say that, he was never alive. There never was anything like God. But for a long time, people had this mythology that there was a God. They needed that, you know, a father figure to go through all of the difficulties. But now we know, now the modern science knows, we don't need that anymore. So therefore, God, the conception of God is dead. You were never really alive, you know. Totally demoniac. So we were asking those questions philosophically, you know, reading Western philosophers. I never got into Eastern philosophy in my early 60s anyway. But at least the question was there. You know, does life have a meaning? Something like that. So this is what is great about, you know, Prabhupada's books, about the Vedic literature, the Vedas, is that of course it does. Of course it has a meaning. And here's the meaning. And here's the meaning of this whole thing. And that is that it's a reflection of the real world. You know, ultimately, this has a nature of a dream world. But the dream is there. It's been created for you to work out your dream of being separate from the Supreme Lord of God and having your own dream to enact life after life where you're the protagonist. You know, that's the nature of it. And so you could say it's there to help you fulfill your karma, to help you fulfill your unfulfilled desires. But that's one side of the meaning. The other side is, because there's a person behind it, and that person ultimately cares about us, because we're his children, aham bija padak prada. It's very important to think of it that way. That he makes arrangements so that if you want to, you can get out. If you keep questioning, you know, just like Gopal Kumar and you know, the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, is that he's never satisfied that this is it. This is all there is. You know, Indraloka, Chandraloka, what to speak of Marchaloka. You know. No, that's not all there is. There's something higher, 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 until you get to Krishna. So the inquiring mind, and by the efforts of great souls like Srila Prabhupada, who reach out at great risk to themselves in order to give us this knowledge, we can now understand that the higher meaning of this world is an arrangement for us to get out of it. To train the mind, train the intelligence, train the senses, so that we can ultimately go back to Godhead and be in our original home with Krishna. That's the real meaning. Very satisfying. Then everything falls into place. There's nothing, you can't walk out in the street or go to Timbuktu somewhere where this philosophy doesn't pertain. Everything pertains. There's somebody, you know, they may speak a different language. All right, they're controlled by the mode of ignorance. There's the mode of goodness acting. You know, here's the earth, water, fire, air, and ether that I had back in San Diego. Where doesn't the philosophy pertain? Every experience, everything you perceive, is contained perfectly within this Bhagavad philosophy. You can understand it. So that's very encouraging for the inquiring mind. But you have to be willing to come to the conclusion that you found it. That yes, you should still inquire, but about, you know, the details, about the varieties of the same absolute truth. Not that you're still holding on to the search as everything. Okay, now here's Hindu philosophy. You know, now let me go search Buddhist philosophy. Now let me go search. American, you know, the Native Americans, they have an interesting thing. Let me try up. What do they do that thing with the 4 days in the teepee, you know, and sweat everything out? Maybe that'll be good, and I'll find out some more truth that way. That's a waste of time. That's a diversion. This philosophy contains all of it. You know, the American Indians, or the, you know, that fits in somewhere near the mode of ignorance. Let's face it. Savages. I mean, I don't have anything against them. You know, one thing that they had that modern people don't have is a sense of the unity of nature, and this, you know, and fitting in with nature and being part of it. People are so alienated today; they don't even know where the food comes from. Where does it come from? Well, it's either Vons or Ralph's, one of the two, right? Hare Krishna. People are so ignorant. So in that sense, they had, you know, and there are some nice Native American devotees who come from that, I assume. You see a lot of that in Flagstaff. They're very prominent there. The Hopis are there and all kinds of things. You know. And they like chanting and dancing. They're chanting also. So. But the point is that, you know, I'm reflecting on my days back when I had a keen mind and, you know, investigating all those philosophies. It was very exciting in one sense. You felt that you were discovering new things. You were thinking about the world in a different way, you know. But that's also a subtle kind of sense gratification for the intelligence. It's a subtle intelligence that you always have to figure some new way of looking at things. So you become like a dilettante, you know. You never actually come to the point of diving in and following one philosophy, you know, and one process. And so that becomes, my brother was like that, you know, bless his soul. He's still alive. But, you know, so much of the Greek philosophy, this philosophy, that philosophy. So then when I talked about Krishna consciousness, he saw this in terms of that. He tried to, you know, pull it apart in terms of what he'd read and about Kierkegaard and all these guys, you know. And ultimately he couldn't get past the idea of bad things happening to so-called good people. The Holocaust, you know, the Jews, you know, all those millions of Jews, that just hung him up. He couldn't believe that there was a merciful, all-powerful, all-good God who would let that happen to all these innocent Jews. It's a huge hang-up, you know, for most people. I try to explain karma, but that just gets them angrier. That these poor little Jewish kids did something in their past life to deserve that.
What past life? I mean, how many animals did they slaughter?
Of course.
What Nazis did to them is nothing what they daily did to so many animals.
I know. The thing is, that's the truth. But the truth hurts. Yeah. You know, the truth hurts. I like to tell this story, of one prominent fellow in London, in England. He was some coach for a big soccer team they had there. You know, famous guy. And he said something to the effect that these disabled people going around in wheelchairs, they did something in previous life. He talked about that. He must have read it in Journey of Self-Discovery or something. And boom, that was it. They came down like a ton of bricks on that guy.
Yeah.
That, you remember that incident? And he had to quit his job and everything, you know, to try to suggest that our victimhood, you're attacking our most precious thing, our victimhood, you know. To be a victim is great. You know, you can sue people, you know, you can get things built for you, you can get famous, you know. Believe me. But now you're saying that we deserve it? No, it doesn't work. So it's a very heavy philosophy. But it all makes sense. It all makes complete sense. And then, only then, can you truly believe and truly understand that God is all good and all merciful and all loving. And that all the things that happen, from Fukushima to this, to the Holocaust, to so many horrible, horrible things, are still, you know, just. It's still good. It's still all good. You know, it's very hard from our perspective. But that's what Krishna consciousness means, to see things from Krishna's perspective. To start to see the world from this vision of eternity. Read the 13th chapter. Those who have the vision of eternity, the spiritual vision, they understand the super soul is there and the super soul is all good. So that's particular verse talking about how everything is entering into everything else is very fascinating. One of the things that we understand is that there's different kinds of bodies. different percentages of these things. Just like Lord Brahma, the creator, said that sometimes his body is all pervasive throughout the universe. It's chiefly made of intelligence. But there's some earth, water, fire, ether, and mind in there. You see? But not the same percentage as us. Now, if you have a body that's almost completely made of intelligence, you can see how long-lived it would be. Right? The longevity was there. If you have a body made of these gross elements like this, clearly this machine is going to break down pretty quickly. This just makes more sense. But even if it didn't make sense, it would be true. But that's the, and there's fire bodies. Why not? Why not? Oh, no, there can't be anything living on the sun. Why not? There's a whole world up there. We see it as all fire. But there's a sun god. There are entities up there, higher beings. And there's everything we have here. But the percentage, now there's water up there. There's also earth. But the fire element is more prominent. So that's what Krishna says right in the second chapter. Sarvagata, the soul goes everywhere. Not that individual souls are all pervading, but that every place we look, there are souls, there are living entities in every environment. And each one of them has voluntarily given up the association of Krishna to try to have a dream, this dream of being independent and enjoying. So this philosophy, now this chapter is great. I was looking ahead. It's quite a long chapter. And it goes into all sorts of things about the transmigration, how the mind works. I'm going to miss some of these as I go to Canada. But I remember reading this Uddhava Gita many years ago in a different translation, and how it was just, even more than the Bhagavad Gita was. I had read that, but when I read Uddhava Gita, it really just impressed me, as this is the philosophy. This is, Krishna speaking. And it just makes complete sense. And it helped me to embrace bhakti yoga as the real truth. Okay, any questions, any comments on these few points? Balaram Das. Go ahead.
So, it's one thing to, because we're meant to understand the philosophy and live by it, but it's one thing just to read it and memorize the shlokas and know the basic ideas, but in terms of actually deeply understanding it, what is the proper way to do that?
Well, Krishna talks about that, that it's not just a question of theoretical knowledge. Gyan has to mature into vigyan, but vigyan is direct perception, probably call it scientific knowledge, meaning science being pratyaksha, we're measuring things, and you can actually, pratyaksha means direct perception. So, Krishna reveals the truth of these matters gradually, proportionally, according to our surrender and according to our devotion. It comes out nicely in those four essential verses in the 10th chapter, where, he states, Aham sarvasya bhavaho mattak sarvam bhavartate. That's more or less the first point he's making. I am the source of everything. Everything emanates from me. Okay, I believe it. I haven't realized it. I haven't seen Krishna create everything. I haven't seen all those elements emanating yet. But I understand it. At least I accept it as truth. I have faith it is true. Okay? So then what does he say? Okay, if you accept it as true, then with all your heart, you worship me. Aham sarvasya bhavaho mattak sarva iti madva pujante mam bhuda bhava samanvita. That second part of the verse. So the first part is like sambandha. The real essence of sambandha, which is understanding this world and the environment, ourselves, is that Krishna is the source of everything. What part of that source, or part of that everything, is us. Another part is the material world. So Krishna is there, I'm there, we're just reading about it, different elements, the relationships. There's a lot to understand there. But the basic point is that everything is coming from Krishna. So he gives that essence of sambandha. Then he gives the essence of abhideya. Abhideya is the practice. To realize the knowledge, it has to be the practice. So he says, iti mudva, one who understands this, they worship me, bhajante mam. Right? with all their heart, Buddha, intelligent, Buddha, the intelligent person, excuse me, Buddha Bhava Samanvita, with full on. You know, that's the key. Now, Krishna doesn't leave us. And then the next verse tells you how to do that worship. He gives some, you know, how much can you give in one verse? But he gives the essence, Machitta. Think of me. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. That's one way. Think him, all of the things with the deity worship. There's so many ways of thinking with Krishna, studying, chanting shlokas. You know, that's Machitta. And Madgata Prana. Not just some philosophical, exercise, but giving your life energy to Krishna. Madgata prana. In other words, everything that you do with your senses and mind and intelligence and everything has to be linked up to Krishna. Under instruction, spiritual master, authority, how to do it. Nectar of devotion. Read the nectar of devotion. So madgata. Then, here's where the nectar comes in. Bodhi yantak parasparam. We have this word paraspara here. Back and forth, back and forth. Speaking about me. Bodhi yantak, enlightening each other. You know? Katayantas, the talk, the Krishna Katha, we're doing it right now. Nityam, always or regularly, right? And it's pleasurable. Tushyanticha, the manticha. It nourishes one spiritually, you enjoy kirtan. Kirtan is the most perfect kind of Krishna Katha, mutual Krishna Katha. People hear, chant, like that. Some hear, some chant. So then what happens? Without that second verse, you know, you don't understand the first part of the first verse. It may be theoretical, but it doesn't mean anything to you. So that has to be there. And then, tesham, to those who are acting in that way, satatiyuktanam bhajatam, will worship me with love and devotion. I give the intelligence. I enlighten them from within, by which they can continue to come to me. Things, you know, become clear. And then the final verse, out of his mercy, is compassion, empathy, able to come, ahama jnana jam tamaha. So all of this darkness that we feel in the heart, you know, is coming from ignorance. Many years, lifetimes of cultivating ignorance. So it's kind of covering the heart, covering our understanding, covering our feelings, everything. Ahamagyana jamtamaha, nashyami, I destroy it. With what? The shining lamp of ignorance, the shining lamp of knowledge. Nashyami atma bhavasto, he's situated there. Right? Krishna's there as a super soul. So with that shining lamp of knowledge, jnana deepena, basvata, very, you know, bas is baskar, that which makes shine, which makes effulgence, it's a word for the sun, the baskar, basvata. So there you have it, Balaram Das, is that, yes, we can understand all these things theoretically, but until we act on that knowledge, thinking, feeling, willing, so we have the thinking, and then I come to the point of willing, and ultimately the feeling will be there, the actual bhakti, the ruchi, the attachment and love for Krishna. And then Krishna will, you know, shower us with so much realization. It's all there, first chapter. Our first canto, second chapter, text 6 to 20 or 21. Ending in, you know, the last five verses talk about hearing and chanting. The progressive purification. And then the last verse ends with the last line, drishta evatmanishu. You see directly Krishna within the heart. Drishta evatmani ishvare. That's all progressive. You know, we're on the progress. The question of how fast we go, that's up to us, according to our sincerity. So everything is there for us, but we have to follow step by step the process of purification. But a very important part of it is called theoretical knowledge, the understanding of everything that's going on, so that our faith can be strong and our will can be strong to act properly. Hare Krishna. Any other questions or comments?
Sorry.
Okay.
Something's making me cough. I don't know what it is.
All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Hare Krishna.